When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Well, here we are, you guys. Once again, everyone talks to Liz, and I'm so thrilled you're tuning in. You know, we talk a lot about tech and big tech, et cetera. When I describe a company as a tech giant, I mean, what pops into your head? I'm assuming probably computers, coding, servers, artificial intelligence, microchips, you know, Intel, Apple, Microsoft, et cetera. But what about when I say tech entrepreneur? Maybe you picture something that's similar to that. I mean, somebody with a computer science degree, a pro computer programmer, engineer, software creator. But would your mind ever go to somebody with maybe a history degree, a board member of the Royal Shakespeare Company, an expert in Greek language and Latin? You know, I mean, right? Probably not. Well, Mark Foster, head of IBM Global Services, is that guy. He took the road less traveled, but it still led him to a tech giant nonetheless, IBM, where today he runs the huge division of more than 240,000 employees. You know, sometimes mastering the pivot and seeing the world through a different lens can really give you perspective you need to succeed in business and wherever you want to go, if you just go in a different direction first. But don't hear this from me. Let's hear it from Mark. We welcome Mark Foster from IBM. Welcome to Everyone Talks to Liz.
Liz, great to be with you. Great to be with you.
Okay, I just have to say this because I'm fangirling here about the Royal Shakespeare Company. You're a board member, right?
I've just stepped off the board after my board membership there. I was there, I timed out on my board membership there, but I'm actually a member of the Royal Shakespeare America's board. Now I'm over here, which is a board that supports the Royal Shakespeare's work back in the UK. So that's where I am right now.
Brilliant. You know, I'm fangirling because my mom is a formerly trained theater Shakespearean actress from the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art in London, RADA. You have to say it like that with the twirling R, right?
You do indeed, exactly. Well, no, it's been a fantastic part of my life being involved with the Royal Shakespeare Company and indeed with theatre in the round. In fact, I did actually spend a lot of time even at school being a stage lighting director. I was in charge of stage lighting in my school for about 3 years at one point. So it was an early exposure to the theatre. Never in front, never actually walked the boards, but actually did everything else behind the scenes.
Yeah, walking the boards is the big moment, right? But, you know, lighting, you got nothing without lighting. Mark, you grew up the son of two artists. What kind of art were they in? Tell me about your folks and growing up in the life that you led.
Yeah, well, my mum was a painter and drawer, actually. And my dad was a graphic artist. In fact, my dad went on to become the head of graphic design at the BBC, in fact, in his early career. And so, but there was a time when television graphic design was all done by hand. And so I grew up in a house that was full of bits of coloured cardboard, double-sided sticky tape and things like that, which were part of creating all the things that were going on the screen in those days. And obviously my father then grew up to run the division in the BBC at the time that did all of that. So I had an opportunity, I guess, I must admit, to grow up in a house that had, you know, a lot of sort of artistic thinking around it, but also an interesting connection to business insofar as, you know, in the end of the day, my father was running a decently sized part of the business of the BBC at the time when he got into that. So it was a mix of those experiences that I had the opportunity to be exposed to. I must admit that the true artistic gene went with my younger brother, who is a fabulous, a natural artist. My creativity was sort of limited to sort of creating things of different natures. So I grew up, you know, creating board games for myself and writing books, and small books for myself and my brother and my family. And even wrote my own newspaper for a while. I created around our house at the time. So those are things I grew up. Those are things I grew up doing. Back at my creative line took a completely different route to many others in that respect.
Did you convince the cat and the dog to read your newspaper?
That's what I basically had to do. It had a very small readership of me, my mum, and my brother, basically.
You know, it almost sounds really, really enchanting. I would imagine, though, with your dad, that eventually when things computerized, you got to watch it all in action, and you probably got to see the early forms of computers, right?
Very early forms, exactly. I mean, obviously, there were some of the very early forms were beginning when my father, actually, he retired quite early and, in fact, became an antique dealer. And so my parents became antique dealers for the next almost 25 years of their lives. So they had a second career as antique dealers. And as he was retiring, obviously, the first beginning of technology coming into the world of graphics. And obviously, you know, I did keep up with that somewhat through his friends who stayed in their business after that. So got some exposure over that period of time.
You went to Oxford, which of course is the best of the best, but to study ancient Greek? This is fascinating to me.
Yes, well, I must admit, I mean, when I was at school, some of the few things I was really good at school was ancient languages that no one spoke anymore. I was from the age of 11 and 12. I was very interested in obviously ancient history and languages and literature that came from that. All the other historians and the great playwrights of ancient Greece. And I must admit, I grew up, you know, just really enjoying that whole area. So when it came to actually looking for what I was going to do as a degree, in fact, there was no choice about it. I'd spent my years of 16, 17, 18 solely studying Greek, Latin, and ancient history. And I went on to Oxford to study what was called Greats, which was a four-year course that focuses precisely on all of that. And so I spent 4 years at University College Oxford, you know, getting a degree in all of that.
I want our listeners to understand where this is all leading. I mean, you were learning and studying languages, and of course, computers have their own language. But getting into the computer realm happened, it feels like, almost serendipitous for you. Can you explain how you came to go to a job fair where you found a job that involved computers?
Yes, well, I did go to a job fair at Oxford, where obviously all the big companies came through to arrange jobs. And one of those was actually then the management consulting division of then called Arthur Andersen. And they were what became eventually Andersen Consulting and then Accenture as organization over time. And they were saying that they were prepared to take anybody from any background and train them in this growing and new world of technology and computing that was out there. And I must admit, I was actually intrigued, because I thought that, frankly, the other paths that were in front of me with my degree and my background, which I was interested in terms of becoming a teacher, I actually had a job all lined up to go and become a classics teacher at a school. But I thought to myself, actually, this sounds really, really more intriguing, more stretching, more different. And I also could see the world was, this technology thing was about to become quite big. It's 1983 now, and you know, tech is beginning to appear on the horizon more visibly in our lives. And so I was lucky enough to get a job there. And within a month, I was in Chicago being trained to code in COBOL, which I did find actually had some very interesting similarities to trying to decline and conjugate, you know, Latin verbs and nouns, because it's just as unforgiving. It's just as unforgiving. Getting an ending wrong in a Latin noun is just as unforgiving as not putting the syntax right in your COBOL statement. So actually, the care you take around your dactylic hexameter scanning is just the same as the care you have to take on understanding how to use working storage.
Well, except that there are IT guys who can help you, but with ancient Greek, it's and who knows? I mean, Julius Caesar isn't around. I mean, thank God to help us all. But you spent 27 years at Arthur Andersen, a lot of different roles. What bridge did you cross to get to IBM eventually? That's an interesting jump to go from Arthur Andersen to IBM.
I moved out of the world of, if you like, of coding to the world of strategic consulting, the world of change management consulting. expertise in certain industries. And then I started running large parts of the business as time went on, and ended up, you know, I was on the management committee, I guess, for the last sort of 10 years. Mm-hmm. I was at Accenture, and I retired from that actually in 2011. And then sort of started thinking about, frankly, enjoying my life doing other things. So I joined the board of several companies, some of which were in the technology arena or related areas. But my main interest, actually, I helped the UK government. I became one of the four commissioners that were put in place to oversee the UK's global aid budget. So in fact, I spent 4 years traveling the world, frankly, ending up in clinics and under trees and schools around the world, understanding whether the UK's aid was making a difference or not. Wrote about 40 reports that were public reports and reported into Parliament, and stood in select committees discussing the impact of aid, which is a fascinating exposure to another whole world. And frankly, had not thought about going back into a full-time role. But I had made the terrible error of, one of the boards I was on was a headhunting company called Hydrogen Struggles.
And they're the biggest of the big, right?
Exactly. And rather too many people there knew of me. And so when IBM was looking for someone to take on the part of their services business, my name was mentioned to them. And I was invited to a breakfast with Ginni Rometty, who was CEO at the time. And within 4 weeks, I had given up all my boards, moved myself and my wife across the Atlantic, and settled into what at the time was running what was then, you know, the global business services part of IBM, which was you know, a pretty interesting moment of my life, it's fair to say.
Would you say that you had any angst or nervousness about it? I mean, this is a big different move, but part of what we find with all of our Everyone Talks to Liz superstars like yourself is that opportunities fly past you in packages you might not recognize, but you need to grab them.
I would absolutely view this as one of those situations. It's interesting in terms of both the timing. It just happened to come along when our youngest son had just finished school, and was therefore, we were able to, you know, frankly, you know, leave him and his brother back in the UK and take a role like this. So it was a moment in time. It was also a role that was actually quite shaped like my background had been at my role at Accenture, though on a different scale and nature, but I knew the different elements of it. Therefore, I had some sense that it was something that I would be able to do and could succeed at. But it was though fundamentally a major leap of faith, both for my wife and I to transport ourselves to live abroad and work abroad for the first time fully over my career, but also to enter into a very different culture and organization, where I knew I was coming into a very senior role, but I didn't have the background. All my prior work life had been in a place that I'd grown up in over several decades. So stepping into a new organization with a different culture, learning how to get things done, that was a big leap of faith. But I think, again, I think you really do have to seize these opportunities when they come along, because if the circumstances are right, the opportunity to do something that generally stretches you and is going to, you know, get the whole gray matter functioning again in new ways, I think is really important.
We're not done yet. We'll be back in a moment.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search. Match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Klayman. Just go to Indeed.com/Klayman right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Klayman. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Was there a moment where you felt like you had to fake it till you made it? That's the issue. I mean, I got recruited by CNBC back in 1998 out of local news where I was covering murders and drug busts and explosions and you know, chocolate festivals to talk about the stock market, about which I knew just about nothing. But I figured, let me fake it till I make it. It's not so easy. You do stumble into some manholes, do you not?
You do. I mean, I speak clear. I think, first of all, I think that the main thing I knew I was going deeper into were areas of technology that I maybe hadn't touched so much. Though I had been, you know, in and around technology now for, you know, 2 or 3 decades. So I was actually in a zone that I at least, you know, knew the zip code of what we were talking about. It did involve, frankly, you know, building on the curiosity that I'd had, frankly, from that boy writing a newspaper for his mother and father. You build on that, and that curiosity, it leads you into understanding new areas like artificial intelligence, like blockchain, like quantum computing, all of the things that actually are some of the, you know, the new areas that are evolving over recent times. And that actually, I think, is something that, you know, it's not a function of a case of faking it to make it. It's actually a function of being, you know, I think, always appropriately humble while you're on the journey of learning those things, yes, while also trying to bring the expertise you do have to bear around the areas that are your more comfortable part of your background.
And do you think that when you did serve for 4 years as the commissioner for the UK's global aid and serving in some of the poorest areas of the world, from the Congo to Somalia to Bangladesh, that those experiences where you were, I'm sure, learning every single second of your waking day, helped you stretch that muscle by the time you got to IBM? And what lesson should that be to our listeners?
I think absolutely it stretched me. It stretches every single sense of your body is stretched by those kind of experiences. And I think that was important. I also think, though, it puts everything into perspective. And I'd say that's a sort of a line of sight from actually my degree in classics through to that experience with the Aid Commission, through to taking on any kind of big leadership role, is a recognition of putting things into perspective, understanding what is important, putting things in the context of the arc of time, as opposed to responding always to the short-term, immediate, near-term stimulus that are around you, because you recognize that there are bigger issues in play that put things in perspective when an issue lands on your desk. It also makes you recognize that, you know, there's going to be a longer arc of time before or after where the moment you're in right now. Mm. And certain things that seem really important this morning won't be important by this evening, but frankly, definitely won't be important by next week, and certainly won't be important in 3 quarters time, and probably definitely not important in 10 years time. So these are things I think that are really important for us to understand as leaders, that while you're always balancing the need to be responsive and immediate in what you do, I think seeing things in a bigger pattern, I think, is a really important thing. And even actually when you're trying to talk about something like technology or transformational change in a company, which I do now, I think we see it over the arc of transformation that's going on. So as I think now about the advice we're giving companies about how they respond in a post-COVID environment,
yeah,
even before COVID, we were talking to them about the impact of technology on transforming their business, of how it was stepping up. Every company was becoming a technology company. There was a real move for it being something that was on the edge of your digital transformation, going deeper into the company. Hmm. You now look and see that although there's been acceleration during this last short period of time, which short period of 18 months of sitting in our kitchens working, but now looking out and seeing that, in fact, it's going to be another, you know, decade of transformation in front of us, where all this stuff is going to come to maturity. And I think it's being able to understand that overall picture that I think is something you just learn.
So you've got a couple hundred thousand employees under you and or working with you. What has changed forever when it comes to the workplace post-COVID? I'm really interested in hearing the answers from people like you.
Well, first of all, I mean, I do think that 240,000 people, you know, first of all, responded, you know, incredibly well to what was clearly a once in a lifetime experience of suddenly finding themselves having to transform where they were working from, how to support clients while dealing with everything else around their lives that's been in turmoil. And frankly, there are still large parts of my teams around the world that are going in and out of lockdowns and still dealing with very major issues as they operate in places where the vaccinations haven't yet landed, where there's still lockdowns occurring. So it's been a, I think it's been a world where people have had to show unbelievable resilience, adaptability, just to do that. And I think that, frankly, the first thing for the teams was to make sure that they felt that we had their back around that, to make sure that, you know, that we were looking, thinking about their well-being, and that we did make some pledges about how to work with people when the rest of their lives were still having to be handled around their workday in different ways. I think some of that thought process now has to carry itself forward, because I do think that people are going to be in this hybrid working model more than they were before. It will be the case that my consultants will not be getting on a plane every Monday morning to fly to a client, to fly back on a Thursday evening.
I agree.
To work from home, they're not going to do that. They're going to do they'll do it some of the time. They have to do it some of the time, because I believe that client intimacy and being close to your clients and working on certain kinds of creative activity absolutely require you to be in the same physical space. But a lot of things don't, and we've learned, in fact, that our teams can perform amazing work virtually from anywhere in the world to anywhere in the world as part of our approach to what we call dynamic delivery and our garage model. And I think the learning that brings to us, and the comfort that our clients have, that they haven't got to see and touch all the people that are working for them, to know that the work is going on, or that the deliverables are being created, or that value is being created. I think that's something that we should now take advantage of to create perhaps more balance in the lives of all the people that work for us, while also recognizing, though, that we need to be careful that there are ditches on all sides of this. There's definitely ditches with regard to, you know, mental health, of loneliness, of isolation for those who find it harder to not be part of a natural social environment in the workplace. And I think we've got to recognize, therefore, there's a real mix of reactions that are going to go on. Different roles are going to have to be done in different ways. But I don't think it will ever go back to being how we were before.
I agree. Could not agree more. I really feel like there are things that will revert, but others that will change forever. And it's called evolution. We do evolve when we learn from these things. Speaking of evolution, do you have the next evolution in your world, in your life? I mean, is there another reinvention of Mark Foster coming?
Well, there may or may not be another reinvention down the track. Right now, clearly the focus is on driving the growth of what is of the services business in IBM, which is actually at a really interesting, you know, junction. I mean, I genuinely believe, as we look out at what all these organizations around the world are now facing in terms of the degree of change they're trying to bring about, the speed and certainty of that change they want to go through, they're going to need help to do that. Help with the technology, help with the execution, help with the creativity about how to really get the most out of that change process. So I think we are, on the cusp of a golden decade for businesses like ours in helping organizations go on those journeys of transformation. And that's an exciting prospect to be part of. And I think, obviously, as I say, IBM itself is continuing to reinvent itself. The focus that's come since Arvind, the CEO, has focused in on the difference we can make, particularly around transformation related to AI, transformation related to the whole power of the hybrid cloud as a way of empowering and changing companies. But in the end of the day, those technologies need people to help them be applied. And that's really the part of the business that I'm excited about leading, is getting the people trained up, brought on board from around the world to work with clients wherever they may be, to get the value out of all this technology at the end of the day. And so that's kind of plan A. In the future, who can tell? I mean, I do still, you know, find, you know, many other interests. I'm still fascinated by the theater. I'm still, you know, a fanatical photographer. I love travel, and I love, you know, seeing different parts of the world. In fact, the part of my job I'm missing most is actually being with my teams around the world, because, you know, this kind of leadership role, indeed the leadership role I had at Accenture before I retired, was all about global leadership of teams and meeting clients and being in the field. And the piece of this job that's been hardest for me over this last 18 months is being, you know, here, trapped in one place, trying to inspire, motivate, connect with, understand people and clients from afar. And I think that's something that, again, back to my experience of working for the Commission, when I first signed up for the job, they told me it would be 40 days done from London, reviewing materials seen by others. It became 100 days a year, all in the field, all personal experience. Wow. To underpin the reports that we wrote. And that to me talks to actually how I like to lead, how I like to feel, able to connect with what's going on, understand what's going on, and then be able to be effective. So I do find that piece missing, and I imagine therefore that whatever I choose to do next will have a lot of that getting out and about for as long as I'm able to get out and about for.
Oh, it sounds like you've got a lot more living to do by choice, certainly. Mark, it's great to talk to you. Before we go, do you have a favorite Shakespearean play that speaks to you from a life standpoint or anything like that? I'll tell you, you know, I used to study these a lot, especially I got yelled at in iambic pentameter by my mother growing up because, you know, being the Shakespearean expert there. But Richard III, to me, just is such a human story of drama and life and pride and hubris and fatal flaws, etc. But is there one that you like in particular?
I find Richard II actually is the play that I find most compelling. Mainly again, though, for the same ideas, that it talks to the issues of hubris, the issues of actually recognizing as a leader that while you may think you're the main man, there's an awful lot else going on. And frankly, being able to recognize the reality of that, be self-reflective and understand that the path to damnation or trouble lies down missing that is really key. So for me, I think it's always being very self-aware of yourself and frankly, not getting too big for your boots is a pretty good lesson for us all to learn.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. Let's end it at that. Mark, what an honor and a pleasure to hear from somebody who works in a huge corporation like IBM in technology, but with such a renaissance outlook on life. I think that has made you a success, and I hope that our listeners really seize upon that and understand that sometimes when you go in a completely different direction, it will still lead you to where you thought you wanted to be in the first place. Thank you so much for joining Everyone Talks to Liz.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure, Liz.
Oh, it's great. Terrific. And to all of you, thank you for tuning in. So appreciate when you seize upon these stories, listen to them, and hopefully take them and run with them toward your goals. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Hi, everybody. It's Brian Kilmeade. I want you to join me weekdays at 9 a.m. East as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and, of course, what you think.
Listen live or get the podcast now at BrianKilmeadeShow.com.